I'm Natalie Hutchison with UN News. Polarization and divisive language could be a major impediment to reaching the ambitious Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs, and the world needs to prioritize youth education to reach targets by 2030. That's from former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, who also previously served as envoy for the Middle East Quartet, which includes the UN. He sat down with Dan Thomas, who heads up communications for the UN Global Compact, the world's largest corporate sustainability initiative, at the recent UN Web Summit in Lisbon, Portugal. Having spent a decade in power from 1997, Mr. Blair began by explaining the early development of the Millennium Development Goals, MDGs, a precursor and blueprint for today's SDGs.
I think when we began the MDG process, we were pretty skeptical as to whether it would amount to more than warm words, as it were. And then as things started to happen, I mean, okay, we, you know, didn't meet some of the very ambitious targets that were set, but it did actually have an impact on government's behavior. And then in the 2005 G8 summit, which the UK chaired, we made big commitments around aid and so on, which made a real difference. So I think then when it came to the SDGs, people were even more ambitious. My only worry is, you know, that the ambitions are very broad and we need to sort of translate them into concrete points of action, because otherwise it just ends up as, you know, basically whatever one would, motherhood and apple pie. So we've got to be, I think, much more specific now on what are the action points that arise out of each of these goals.
Well, indeed, there were 8 Millennium Development Goals, there's 17 Sustainable Development Goals and 169 targets. So it's a very, very broad agenda. Do you feel that the SDGs, you know, in your travels around the world, do you think that the SDGs are gaining traction in society, with governments, with the private sector?
Yeah, I think at a certain level they are. But I think that people find them still hard to grasp in terms of, well, what does that mean that I should be doing? You know, so if you go down the list of them, then there are more of them. You know, then I think it becomes harder for people, if they're in politics, to translate that into, as I say, things that mean there's going to be concrete action happening. So I think, look, one of the things that's happened in the world in the last few years is it's much more obvious what works and what doesn't. I mean, you do have action that you can take based on experience and based on actual experiments that people have done that make a difference on things like healthcare, the environment, education, and so on. So I think what is necessary is for each of these different SDGs to be then translated, as I say, into a program. And then you've got to get some real, you know, I mean, part of the trouble is, at the moment, the world's quite divided, okay? So it's not clear whether there's the leadership there collectively in the world to make a big difference. So this is the problem that you have. Whereas, you know, I was at a fortunate period in a way when I was in office that people really, you know, people felt there was a real impetus behind those MDGs. And, you know, even though, as I say, they didn't fulfill all the things they were supposed to, on the other hand, you can go through them and say, well, there actually was a significant difference made. So I think we've got this challenge of concretization of the SDGs, and then we've got the challenge of global leadership, which is right now tough.
Indeed, and that's a challenge that you're taking on with gusto. Education's one of your institute's focuses. What are you hoping to achieve with this global commitment to promote global citizenship and prevent violent extremism?
That's, right, so this is SDG an example 4. Of where you might take an SDG, yeah, and turn it into something very specific. So basically, the SDG is about quality education. And there's a lot of work that's been done in the past few years on enrolling more people in schools. But there are two problems with that. If you don't improve the quality of what they're being taught, then you can put more people in the classroom, but often they're just there in the classroom, they're not necessarily being taught very well, right? So you've got a whole series of things around education reform, and then you've got something else which is really important. In today's world, the most important thing is to teach young people to think creatively, right? To think imaginatively. so that they because technology gives people the opportunity to learn facts, right? Your teacher is no longer someone who's telling you the facts as it used to be when I was at school. Your teacher is someone who's got to guide you through the maze of information that comes to you today, right? But what is really important is to make sure that the young people are being taught to think in ways that allow them to question, to be creative, because when they go out into the workplace, that's the skill that's going to be most necessary for them. So often with the very poorest countries in the world even, if you simply enroll children in, for example, primary education, but you're not reforming the systems around primary education, then they're just more kids sitting in a classroom not getting taught very well.
And how can technology make that transition possible?
Technology is essential. And look, the single biggest problem with education in the developing world is, quite apart from issues around teachers and so on and the bricks and mortar of the classroom, is if you've got access to technology, a whole lot of things become possible that are otherwise impossible. So, you know, you can be taught differently. You can obviously study differently. And in the end, in the most imaginative ways people are being taught today, some of the gaps in the quality of the teaching can be made up for with what can be provided by technology. So technology, you know, is essential. One of the things my institute works on is not just how do you promote global citizenship within education systems, but also how do you help particularly remote rural areas get access to electricity so that the children in those areas have the ability to access technology.
Do you feel more optimistic than before with at a place like the Web Summit where these innovators and entrepreneurs are working to overcome these challenges?
I think EdTech is going to become a huge developing area. I think what is really important is to make sure that that isn't just in the wealthier countries. And some of the people that we are working with, because my institute has programs in about 15 to 20 different African countries, we're working with governments there as to how we might use EdTech to bypass some of the legacy problems of Western systems. So this is an enormous opportunity. And people often, I mean, one thing that's really changed, I think, just in the last 2 years is a much greater focus on technology in some of the poorest parts of the world. And people often think, well, technology is a rich country's issue, but it's really not. There's masses of things that can happen, from financial payments to helping, for example, you know, I've seen projects, amazing projects, where women are starting businesses in remote rural parts because they got the mobile technology to do it. And education's the same. So there's a huge amount we can do. And one of the ambitions, one of the reasons I'm here at this summit, is I would like to see us do a major tech summit in Africa with the developing countries, because I think there'd be enormous interest. And by the way, there are really good tech entrepreneurs in some of these African countries today. I mean, again, people might say, well, going back 5 years, you wouldn't have expected that. But you go to virtually any African country today and people are trying to innovate and do startups, and a lot of those are in the education field.
I often think that the people who live in the very poorest countries are the most sustainable, because they kind of have to be in the way that they approach their lives and their work.
Well, they can be more innovative as well, because, you know, one of the issues with the West is how do you reform legacy systems that are built up over a long time, healthcare, education, transport even, and technology gives you the opportunity to go around that.
It's a leapfrog.
Well, it can do. I mean, it can do if it's done properly. And in education, you know, for a lot of young people in developing countries, using technology to educate is going to give them, frankly, a better chance of education than waiting till their systems come up to scratch. Because, you know, we work in countries where you've got statistics that will tell you that 95% of children are getting educated at primary school level. But when you dig down deep, the teachers aren't turning up, they're not qualified when they do, the kids can't actually get to school. So I doubt many of those 95% are getting what we would call education.
Exactly, and they graduate without being able to read and write sometimes.
Yeah, which so it's is, hopeless, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I know that you're concerned about intolerance, hatred. How vulnerable are children to these messages of hatred these days? And And what are you doing to try and combat that?
So there's a general issue, because young people absorb a lot of information through technology. So obviously, you know, technology is a great connector of people, but at the same time, it's a means also of spreading hate speech and extremism. But secondly, in many of the countries we work in, where the education system falls down, then religious elements will come in and provide education, but let's say it's not an open-minded education, right? They're taught a very narrow view of the world. And this is, I think, a problem over time. And, you know, if you look, for example, at some of the schools in northern Nigeria, you know, you can see a direct linkage between some of that and the activities then of Boko Haram. So I think our desire is to get this global commitment on education, the purpose of which is to sign governments up to principles that effectively mean you root out prejudice and promote tolerance within your education systems. So whether it's in the curriculum, whether it's in what's taught informally, you as a government have a global responsibility to make sure your young people are not subject to teaching that is extreme, biased, prejudiced against those of a different faith, culture, ethnicity.
And why now in particular?
Because I think it's perfectly obvious that if you don't educate young people to an open-minded view of the world, one, they're much less able to make a living for themselves. But secondly, you know, that's where the intolerance and extremism grows. And what you're seeing around the world, unfortunately, is people will often use religion. And this is not connected with one religion, but many religions. Religion is a dividing line. Those who don't follow your view of religion or your view of your own religion are then regarded as enemies. People are taught a very narrow nationalism that means that you resent people who don't come from your nation, or it could be tribe. And, you know, young people don't naturally grow up bigoted, actually. They naturally grow up very open to others. And in the programs we run in about 30 different countries, we link up children of different faiths, either within a country or between countries. And when we can get them access to the technology, we can do this reasonably easily. And it's amazing what the results are. The moment young people start to go in dialogue with each other and they learn what it's like to be, if you're a Muslim, what it's like to be Jewish or Christian, or, you know, you're from one country, or even, you know, I attended one of our programs in Jordan a short time ago where some of the children from the students from the Bedouin community were actually linking up with others in the rest of Jordanian society and learning from each other. And then, you know, it's amazing when that interaction happens, a lot of the barriers of prejudice fall down.